Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Today, it's British food personality Nigella Lawson. Now, we talk about England's and Nigella's way with summer fruits. You could call this masterpiece theater syndrome, but for me, the British have always had a lovely kind of old-fashioned simplicity with these fruits. Wine authority Joshua Wesson is into breaking the rules again. He's got summer reds you actually should chill. Then there's the good news and bad news about kitchen knives. The bad news first. What we thought we knew all about them is bunk. The good news? Well, new knife technology makes good knives cheaper. Expert Chad Ward has the brief. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. So you can get to us at 800-537-5252. Let's get started with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet magazine. All right, guys, I know you've been doing barbecue research. So what is the latest one?
Well, you know, if you really want to do some serious research into barbecue, there are a few places better to do it than Kansas City. And in fact, you know, many of the Kansas City places are well known. Arthur Bryant, Gates, Smead's, the Smokestack. We went to a place recently that is not quite so well known, but really belongs in the barbecue pantheon. It's a very humble barbecue place called LC's, not Elsie the cow, but the letters LC. It's a one-room place with with bare tables, a TV blaring in the corner of the room, and first-class barbecue of all kinds. You know, beef, ham, turkey, pork, sausage, and ribs, all pit-cooked for long enough so that the meat just basically basks in its own juices and just gets more and more succulent the longer it cooks. But there was one thing on the LC menu that really impressed us, and that is the burnt ends.
I love those. Do you know what those are?
I have an imagination, but tell me what they are.
They're the outside edges of the smoked brisket. And in fact, they're very well done. Almost some of them have a charred edge to them. And they serve them chopped up on a piece of white bread, slathered with a big ladle full of beef juice. And it is just the most delicious sort of congruent flavors, the mushy bread, the oily,
luscious
au jus, and the barbecue sauce, too.
I mean, these are bathed in really great Kansas City-style barbecue sauce, which is very hot and a little bit sweet, kind of that almost sort of curry-like zest to it.
Is Kansas City-style barbecue, is that with the tomato in the sauce?
Yes, it's red, red sauce.
It's reddish, but it doesn't have that kind of very sweet edge to it. It's much spicier, and there is sometimes a little
kind
sweetness
of granular
to it, but it's sort of granular and more orange than red. And I just have to get back to the burnt ends themselves, because, you know, if you're the kind of person who loves the little bits and pieces of a roast when you're carving it, and the little pieces that fall around on the cutting board, and sometimes are just kind of obscenely fatty, you know, and crunchy and a little too well done and juicy as can be and melt in the mouth and sometimes crunchy, that's what burnt ends are all about.
You know, before the food even came to the table, what I loved about this place is there were no napkins. Every table is outfitted with a roll of paper towels, which is kind of my, you know, means big, sloppy, messy food.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, let's not pretend otherwise.
So is there other stuff that goes with this? Is there any side stuff you have to have? Or is it just go in there and go for the burnt ends?
It's basics.
I think there may be some potatoes or something on them. I don't know. But, the fact is you really hit on something. I mean, even if burnt ends are by far the best thing to eat, in my opinion, a plate or a sandwich of nothing but burnt ends is so focused and so intense that it's too much. So I always like to get a plate of like half burnt ends and then maybe half brisket or a length of sausage, just so it isn't all that utter succulence. So my idea of balance is beef and burnt ends on a plate. With some white bread on the side.
And a paper towel.
And God forbid if a lettuce leaf ever entered the door, I got it.
No, this is not lettuce leaf.
Don't go to LC's for a salad.
Hey, guys, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, Lynn, bye.
I woke up this morning in a hospital bed. No, the nurse looking down at me. She must have thought I was dead. They found me sitting underneath a tree. Was out cold by the roadside, but only sleeping, don't you see? So they check my liver and they check my blood and all kind of tests to see what I've done. Called a doctor, intern, a specialist too. Say we don't know what's wrong with you. What's my problem?
Too much barbecue.
Oh, no, no way. What's my problem, man?
Too much barbecue.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you know that you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Last night, once again, I knew the outrageous ambrosia of the slightly withered nectarine. It was a white one, organic, and even though I bought it hard, it had those telltale scents of spice and sugar. Now, the withered part is the key. If you let peaches and nectarines sit out until they're just starting to wrinkle, just starting to pull in on themselves, they are at their voluptuous peak. Now, this is when you do nothing but slice and eat. But if you have to fool around, think nubs of blue cheese, really swell here, or dribble some fresh plum syrup, which you can just do with red wine, plums, and sugar. And the other thing that is good with this fruit is a pinch of Aleppo chili. The fruity sweet heat of this Middle Eastern chili lets all the flavor of those stone fruits shine. Joshua Wesson is my favorite free thinker. He's a wine expert who follows his own drummer. He started out as a very fancy sommelier, and then the paradigm shifted. Now Josh hunts down great, affordable, and often little-known wines around the world. Josh, it's good to have you back.
Always lovely to be with you, Lynn.
Sir, what is the right temperature to serve a red wine at? Yeah, I mean, it's confusing. Room temperature, but cellar temperature.
I know that it's an excellent question, and it's one that a lot of people ask me, too. And, you know, if you go and Google that question, you'll get charts galore. And they'll have a different wine set at just about every temperature that exists between room temperature,
right,
which is about, you know, 72 degrees,
right,
and you're refrigerated, which is, you know, 35 to 40 degrees. And I think that that's getting a little bit neurotic. I mean, it's the same kind of neurosis that infects people who have a different glass for every kind of wine that they serve. I have a Bordeaux glass here, and I can't possibly serve a Rioja in it, and nor could I serve a Chianti or a Beaujolais. I have special glasses for those. And each wine must be served at the perfect temperature. Blah, 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 blah. I don't think so. I think that guidelines, you know, rough guidelines are very helpful. And when it comes to red wine, all you have to remember is that red wine doesn't taste good at room temperature when your room is 68 to 72, nor should red wine be served at refrigerator temperature, which is 35 to 40 degrees. The answer really is somewhere in between, and the fruitier and lighter the red wine is, the colder you can get it. But the vast majority of the red wines that you would drink, that I would drink, that anybody listening would drink, should be served in a range between about 55 and 60 degrees. That's where they're going to taste best.
Which, if I remember my Wine 101, is cellar temperature in big quotation marks.
Right, cellar temperature or, you know, room temperature before rooms were centrally heated, maybe a little bit cooler than that. There's no exact temperature. The exact temperature is the one that you enjoy serving the wine and drinking it at. But what I do with red wines when I'm ready to serve them at home, mm-hmm. or when I'm in a restaurant and I don't like the temperature because they're too warm, in a restaurant, I stick it in an ice bucket for 5 minutes.
Okay.
And then I pull it out of the bucket and sit it on the table and let it warm up on the table. When I'm at home, I put it in the refrigerator for about an hour beforehand, and that brings it down to about 50 degrees, and then I let it come up from there on the table, and it's really interesting to taste a red wine as it moves from 50 to 55 to 60 degrees, because it tastes like a different wine at every temperature point.
That's kind of fun to think about doing.
It's a great sensory exercise to take a bottle of wine that you have at room temperature and pour half of it out, and then take the remaining wine and stick it in an ice bucket for 5 minutes, and then pour that wine into a glass and compare it to the room temperature wine. There's no way that you would say the wine tastes the same, and you probably would think that the wine's wildly different. I do this with my wine geek friends all the time to humble them, and nothing says humility like guessing that the same wine is, in fact, a different wine.
Are there any red wines that you would really chill down, you would refrigerate and serve more or less at the temperature you would serve a white?
Absolutely. And the red wines that you would serve at close to white wine temperatures are red wines that come from cool climates that are usually made from very thin-skinned red grapes, because that's where most of the flavor in a red wine comes from, mm-hmm. and where most of the tannin in a red wine comes from. And tannin gets exaggerated as you chill a red wine. So if you have a red wine that doesn't have much tannin in the first place, then you're going to end up with something that's quite palatable when it gets cool. And you also want to look for red wines that are insanely fruity, because the colder a wine is, the more the fruit gets tamped down. And if you start out with a wildly fruity wine, all that chilling won't numb the fruit into nothingness.
So
thin-skinned, cool climate, and fruity, and you can find red wines from many different parts of the world that fit the bill that can be really treated like white wine.
So when you talk about thin-skinned grapes, we're talking what about? Pinot Noir, right?
Pinot Noir for sure.
And that's where I stop, Pinot Noir.
Well, Gamay is a grape
thin-skinned. Right.
That goes into Beaujolais, and Beaujolais is a wine that can take a chill for sure, especially if it's not too serious a Beaujolais, up to the Beaujolais village level, but not at the individual village level.
Mm-hmm.
But I love Pinot Noirs that are thin-skinned and that come from cool climates. And I love my new favorite chillable red is from Austria, and it's a grape called Zweigelt. And it tastes like kind of like a cross between Gamay and Pinot Noir. It's fun to drink, and they're never very expensive, and you can treat them just like a white wine, and they're a blast. Really,
Zweigelt. Zweigelt.
Zweigelt.
Hey, Josh, thank you.
Pleasure.
Wine Authority Joshua Wesson is Senior Director of Wine, Beer, and Spirits at the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company. Now, you can find Josh's chillable red picks and a recipe for grilled black pepper honey steak to go with them on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out all of our other offerings. There are podcasts, newsletters, and information on our book, How to Eat Supper. Coming up, Summer Fruits with British food star Nigella Lawson and How to Buy a Knife for Modest Money. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. British writer Nigella Lawson has become a food celebrity by insisting that she is not a professional. She's a home cook with a busy life and a family to feed. Now, normally this would be a tad too coy, except no one quite combines Nigella's smarts, her practicality, the way she looks, and her frankly lusty appetite. Nigella, welcome. Good to have you back.
Thank you very much.
Nigella, I want to talk summer fruits. What are you reveling in right now?
Well, this is a terribly English thing to say, but you wouldn't expect any less. But for us, summer fruits means summer pudding. And I don't know if you have summer pudding in the States, but what this is a mixture of any fruits that you can get and maybe past their best, which is useful for right now. They've had the sun on them maybe a little bit too long. Red currants, black currants, raspberries, strawberries, maybe blackberries. We don't normally use those an awful lot. And we line a pudding basin shape with, I'm afraid to say, generally pretty awful plastic bread.
Right.
It's white bread. And you line a pudding basin, you wodge the bread against it, you fill it with this mixture of perhaps bruised red fruits with a little sugar, maybe a teeny bit of lemon. You put a lid on again with some bread, and then you put many weights, you know, can of beans, it doesn't matter what, and you leave it for 3 days. And all the juices soak through the bread, making them scarlet. It's like a scarlet sponge. And then you slice it. It slices messily but deliciously, and you have it with cream. And summer pudding has been going since the Victorian times, and that's certainly my childhood and now my adulthood, because it'd be inconceivable to watch the late summer fruits go by without it.
I'm listing in my mind now, where can I find those berries? And I think I saw the...
But also jam. I think it's very old-fashioned to make jam. And I make a jam with a fantastically old-fashioned name, which is Jumbleberry Jam.
Jumbleberry. What a great
Jumbleberry. Because what it means is any berries you get, you don't need to weigh them, you don't need to think about them that much. Jumbleberry. It's all jumbled up. And I make a jam just by boiling it up for, you know, far too long with a bit of sugar. But for those who don't like to do anything as frightening as waiting for a jam to set, I think there's still time to make fresh raspberry jam, so simple and so beautiful, which is simply that you get equal amounts, just maybe a couple of cups each, of raspberries and sugar, put them into two separate bowls, put these heat-proof bowls in a 400-degree oven for 20 minutes, and then you pour the sugar and raspberries together into a jug, and the heat of the sugar on the raspberries turns it into a red molten river. And it's jam that tastes so fresh. I mean, it doesn't last like proper jam, but believe me, that's never going to be a problem.
You would put it in the refrigerator then, I would gather. And
I
just
would.
Go
it does heat it very, very fast. I mean, when sugar and raspberries come together, turns it into this thick, ruby gravy, if you think. And then you just pot it. And it's also... It's very runny. It doesn't set like jam, but it's fantastic on shortcakes or really just stirred into a little lightly whipped unsugared cream. There's something about it that is just delicious. But really, if you have some very good white bread and some good unsalted butter and then a few teaspoons dribbled on top of that, to me, that would be a very heavenly alfresco breakfast.
I think life would be very, very good.
It would be.
Now, when I think of England, I think of things like damsons. What is a damson plum?
A damson is it's a hard work plum. It's a sourish plum with a stone large out of all proportion to the flesh. So it's not entirely easy to use, but the taste is magnificent. I think the fruit that is more sour, has that edge, has better taste. So, for example, for a damson, once you've almost, you know, left yourself bleeding thumbs trying to get rid of the stones, you've got an intense acid flour, slightly rough textured puree, because that will happen as you cook them very, very simply. And that we would make a damson foule, which comes from the French foulée, to whip, which is just the sour fruit streaked through some softly whipped cream and eaten out of a small wine glass, which is really delicious. But and gin, you know, you can, if you want to cut to the chase, just get a knitting needle or some such and prick some of these plums all over and then let them sit for a month or so in some gin. I mean, I'd rather eat than drink, but that's not everyone.
I think that sounds like an utterly brilliant idea, and I can think of the jar I have at home that it's going to go into this afternoon. You brought up an interesting point, though, about acidity in fruit giving you perhaps a fuller, more complex flavor.
Much more. And, of course, for cooking, of course, as we know, it helps the set. I think one of the exciting things about the berries that are almost tapering off now is that some of them, even when ripe, have that edge of sourness. And that's what gives complexity.
What about the stone fruits, peaches, nectarines?
I think it's sad to cook a perfect peach or a perfect nectarine. However, too many fruits are not perfect. So I think I'd have a couple of choices. I do what the Italians do, you don't need me to tell you, which is to slice up a peach and let it stand in a glass of red wine, which is delicious. I happen to love it in Muscat too, but I love the way Italians do that. And I suppose it's not so far from the notion that the Spanish have with all those great jugs of their fruited red wine in summer.
Same idea.
But I think otherwise, I think there are certain pairings which inexplicably go well. For example, if I have a nectarine that is a bit unyielding and it needs to be cooked before it has proper flavour, for some reason, a nectarine always goes well with blueberries. So I'm quite happy to make a nectarine and blueberry cobbler. Blueberries by themselves are not interesting enough. They need another fruit. They need a sourness. And if a nectarine is too sour to eat, uncooked, that makes good use of it. Or a crisp. You know, I'm perfectly happy to get a few oats and a bit of ground almonds and maybe some sliced almonds, stir in a bit of brown sugar and melted butter and pour that over some sliced nectarines and a tumble of blueberries and bake that. That's a rather fantastic late summer pudding, if you like, something that could be eaten outside with maybe some good vanilla ice cream.
Sounds so good. Oh,
food always does. That's the great thing.
Nigella, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Lynn.
Nigella Lawson is author of Nigella Express. Now, you can find her recipe for that oven jam, hands-free raspberry jam, on the website, splendidtable.org. Where the logic is. We spend money on cookbooks, on ingredients, but when it comes to the first tool that we reach for every time we cook, we cheat ourselves by being cheapskates. Now, I'm talking knives here. The cook's most essential ally, and we pick losers. Badly made and with all the cutting power of a 2x4. Now, there's a lot of misinformation about knives out there, but most of it is debunked in a book by our guest, the knife-obsessed writer and cook Chad Ward. Chad's book is An Edge in the Kitchen. Chad, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, what should we look for in a knife?
The first thing that people are told, you walk into a store and say, I want to buy a knife, and I think knife store clerks are legally required to say, well, of course you must buy the forged knife with the big bolster and the full tang. And that's not true. At one point it might have been true, but the advances in modern steels and in manufacturing technology make the conventional wisdom about kitchen knives look like medieval dentistry. So the first thing is to just ignore that advice completely. There are knives today that are thinner, lighter, harder, and sharper than anything that has ever been produced, and it doesn't have anything to do with forging, bolsters, or full tangs.
Okay, because forging means the knife is heated and cooled and made by hand.
That's the typical picture that we all have, some, you know, burly artisan lovingly, you know, whacking your glowing bar of steel into a kitchen knife, but it's not actually made that way.
And the tang is where the blade actually continues into the handle. The blade is all one piece of steel, and
right,
you can see it going all the way down the length of the handle, and it's riveted in. And the bolster is sort of that pad of metal between the handle and the blade.
Yes, it's
that's
that collar of metal.
That's what you usually grab onto.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So we don't have to worry about any of that.
You don't have to worry about that. The other thing to not do, do not be a blockhead. Do not buy the pre-assembled set of knives in a block, in a box from your local department store or big box retailer. You know, it may seem like a bargain. You know,
right,
you get 9 knives and some shears and a steel for $49.95.
Yeah.
if you take your budget and buy fewer, higher quality knives, you will be a much happier person. You really need two knives. You need a chef's knife. You need a paring knife. You know, throw in a big bread knife and you'll rule the world.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to buy the big set.
Okay, so now let's get more specific. What do you look for that tells you a knife is of high quality?
You look, first of all, the thing that nobody ever talks about, look for a knife that fits your hands. I don't care how high quality it is. If the knife is uncomfortable, you won't use it. So you need to go to a store that will let you handle the knives. The good ones will, you know, be able to, you'll be able to take the knife out of the block and use it. Better stores will even have a cutting board where you can kind of simulate cutting and you get a feel for how it fits your hands. There are two basic styles of knives now. There are the thicker German and French influence knives. Those are the Wusthofs, the Sabatiers, the Henkels that we're used to. Those tend to be thicker, chunkier, heavier. And for a long time, that was kind of the kitchen standard.
Yeah.
There is a new breed of knife influenced by Japanese knives, which are thinner, lighter, harder, and have just screaming sharp edges. But they do take a little bit more getting used to. It's the difference between driving an SUV and driving a sports car.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, aside from there's one very good entry-level knife, they are not going to be inexpensive.
All right. What would you call a good entry-level knife, and can you name names?
Yes, absolutely. The best entry-level knife is made by Forchner Victorinox. Victorinox is the Swiss Army knife company.
Uh-huh.
And they have an entry-level chef's knife. The 8-inch knife is about $20. The model number is 40520. It's got a plasticky Fibrox handle. And unlike many of the inexpensive stamped knives, this one will take a good edge, will hold it for a long time. It's not uncomfortable. It is, you know, if you are outfitting your first kitchen, or if you have a lake or a beach house that, you know, you want to leave a knife there that you don't feel too bad about, or in my case, my daughter's going off to college and I want to pack her something, you know, in the hopes that she'll eat something green every once in a while.
Right.
So, you know, that's the knife. It's a great one. It's $20. The 10 inch is about $25.
That is sensational to know. All right. Let's talk about sharpening the knives. Because this is where we're always hearing about those electric knife sharpeners that ruin your knives. Is there any truth to that?
Yes. Electric knife sharpeners need to be used with extreme caution. There are some good ones out there, but the mistake a lot of people make, you know, many of these electric sharpeners have two and three stages.
Right.
And
right.
That first stage is extremely coarse and will remove metal at an alarming rate. You should use that first stage only in extreme emergency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if your six-year-old has taken your chef's knife out and banged it on the sidewalk for a while, maybe use the first stage to get it back into shape. You know, you should use the highest stage that you can and use it with caution. I mean, you can take a lot of metal off in a hurry.
It sounds like this is pretty tricky. You spend a fair amount of money for these things, and you have to be really skilled to know how to use them. There are other ways of sharpening knives.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that really bugs me is when you have some TV chef who's, you know, says, you know, you can spend 3 hours and, you know, make my authentic French cassoulet, but you're not quite bright enough to sharpen your own knives. You know, that's absolutely untrue. Knife sharpening is not that difficult. For example, if you've got an automotive store nearby, you go get some 600 grit wet dry sandpaper, stick it down to an old mouse pad,
right,
and you can use a stropping motion. If you have ever seen an old-fashioned barber sharpening his razor on a strop, you can use a similar stroke. Yeah. It's a very similar stroke. You just have to be careful not to roll the edge at the end of the stroke. A couple of swipes on that will...
Excuse me, but when you say roll the edge, you mean sort of lift the knife a bit as you're applying pressure to it?
You should not twist or roll your wrist at the end of the stroke because that'll cause the edge to kind of bite into the sandpaper and roll it over, where you really just want to have a clean stop and lift and then change directions.
Mm-hmm.
The key, though, is steeling your knife regularly. You know, sharpening is one thing. Sharpening you can do every 6 months or so. But if you steel your knife regularly, you will keep your edges in peak condition for, you know, 6 months, a year, without any loss of performance.
Now, steeling is not sharpening then. Is that what you're saying?
No. Steeling, what happens when you use your knife, the edge will dull slightly, parts of it will go flat, some of it will roll over to the side on a microscopic level.
Huh.
And so when you steel your knife, you're basically taking that edge, which is still there, but it's just not pointing straight down anymore. And you're kind of pushing it back into position.
So, first of all, what kind of steel do you need? And secondly, how do you do it?
I like high-grit ceramic rods. Because I have a variety of knives, the grooved steels that come with most sets are actually a little coarse for some of the high-performance knives. They'll actually chip the edges of the knives.
Ah.
So a good fine ceramic is more applicable to a wider variety of knives.
And then how do you use it?
The easiest way, you know, everyone has that vision of the chef with his knife and his steel flashing and clanging. Don't do that. That's bad. You don't get the consistency that you need in order to, you know, keep your edges going strong. The real trick is to take your steel. Well, take a tea towel or a side towel, put it on your countertop so that things don't slide around. If you're right-handed, take your steel in your left hand by the handle with the tip pointing down. Put the tip on the towel so that you're basically holding it like a plunger.
Yeah, exactly. It's perpendicular to the counter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then take your knife in your other hand and put the edge perpendicular to the steel, to the rod. So you're basically making a 90-degree angle.
Mm-hmm.
If you rotate your wrist inward and cut that angle in half, you're at 45 degrees.
Okay.
If you cut that angle in half, you're at 22 degrees, which is exactly where your Henkels, your Wusthofs, and your Sabatiers are sharpened. And then just give it a gentle slide from heel to tip.
And
then repeat on the other side. And that's it. A couple of swipes a week will keep your edges going strong.
You should know that right now everyone in the control room was following you step by step with their left hand and their right hand.
Playing air steel.
Chad, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chad Ward is the author of An Edge in the Kitchen, The Ultimate Guide to Kitchen Knives. In my humble opinion, the source list alone at the back of the book is worth the price. Okay, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is about taking afternoon tea British style. Here it is. What information did the British royal household personally approve as correct etiquette when drinking your cup of tea? Well, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was about making afternoon tea in the British style. What information did the British royal household personally approve as correct etiquette when you drink your cup of tea? The uplifted pinky. This is totally correct. You do it to balance against spills. Now, never should you loop your fingers through the teacup handle. You hold it on either side and never cup the cup in your palm. You may never be invited to tea again, at least not by British etiquette writer Ellen Easton. She actually had the royal household review her book on tea etiquette. Well, her goal was to cancel out the loose, scandalous modern mistakes in tea etiquette. Now, for instance, you do not stir your tea with your teaspoon. You fold the sugar in by moving your spoon from the cup's 6 o'clock position to its 12 o'clock position. Milk goes into the cup first because the first teacups were made out of soft paste porcelain, which could crack with the hot tea. Never do you butter your entire scone, Ellen says. Pre-buttered scones may be acceptable in restaurants, but they will never be correct. Now, just in case you're tempted to tell Ellen what to do with all this information, she forestalls with this statement, and I quote, "If one is going to embrace such a lovely and genteel genre, I would like to set the record straight. As a descendant of one of Europe's old-line aristocratic families, I feel privileged to be able to share with you the protocols that have been passed down from century to century." Well, there you go. Give me my coffee mug, please.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me. Tell me and I'll be around. and it seems your friends.
It's time to open up the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have got Dee calling from St. Louis. Dee, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I just got back, my daughter and I just got back from a trip to Italy.
Oh.
And we went from Lake Como down to the Amalfi Coast and ended up in Rome. But while we were in Amalfi, we had this wonderful lemon pasta, or a pasta with a lemon sauce.
Uh-huh.
It was so light and delightful. Both my daughter and I have told people about it, and I would like to know how to make that.
Oh, boy. Describe it to me.
I think it was made with either a linguine or fettuccine pasta.
Right.
Of course, they make their own, so that's much different than what I would pick up at the grocery store. But it was just a light sauce. I think it had a little bit of Parmesan cheese in it.
Did it have any cream in it, or was it?
I don't think so,
uh-huh.
But it could have had.
Was it very lemony?
It was pretty lemony. Mm-hmm.
And did you sense there was olive oil in there? And was
a little bit.
Was there garlic?
A little bit.
And was there lemon zest?
I think there was probably lemon zest.
This may be the simplest of all simple things.
Hey, I'm for that.
Well, this is where I'd have you start,
okay?
Where I'd have you start is, first of all, get some good imported Italian pasta.
Okay.
And that doesn't mean you have to go, you know, jump through hoops to do it, but even something like DiCecco, which is available in a lot of stores across the country.
Okay.
What I think you want is an egg fettuccine, if you can get it, because you want one that you know, you want a pasta that's pretty classy for this.
Okay.
And then what you want to do is film the bottom of a skillet with olive oil, good tasting olive oil. And then you're going to grate or do very fine shreds of lemon zest from an entire lemon. And you'll slice up 3 or 4 large cloves of garlic into very, very thin petals.
Okay.
Gently warm the oil in the skillet. You're going to stir in the lemon zest, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to, don't get it super hot, medium heat at the most. And then you will add the garlic.
Okay.
Meanwhile, you will be cooking the pasta.
Uh-huh.
You're going to add salt and black pepper to that oil mixture. You're just warming it until it's very fragrant. All right?
Uh-huh.
And you've done a generous amount of olive oil.
Okay.
And what you want to do then is you're going to, you're boiling the pasta in boiling salted water, you're going to take about 1/4 to 1/2 cup of that pasta water out of the pot just before you drain the pasta.
Okay.
And you'll pour about, 1/4 cup into the pan with the warm oil. Stand back. You don't want it to spatter you. But you're going to let that thicken that mixture very slightly, and it gives it some seasoning.
Okay.
You've thoroughly drained the pasta. You're going to toss the pasta into the pan, because what that water has done is you've simmered it in just a little bit to reduce it down, but it's literally making a sauce.
Mm-hmm.
It's making that flavored oil into a sauce. And then you're going to squeeze the fresh lemon juice over the pasta.
Oh.
And you will then keep tossing. You don't want to cook the lemon juice. And then you will add the Parmigiano to the amount that you remember being.
It did not have a lot.
No, it wouldn't need a lot at all. It wouldn't need a lot at all. This is really, really delicate. Now, once you taste that, you'll know, do I need more lemon zest?
Uh-huh.
Do I need to use less garlic? Do I want to do a little shaved onion or very finely minced, because that'll be a little sweeter? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes. Yeah, I do.
Yeah. That is, I think, the basic elements of what you had there.
Okay.
Because it's very, very, it's not necessarily a dish I know, but it's very typical kind of thing you would get.
Okay.
And it can be really fabulous.
Sounds good. And
I want you
to know, just before we left, I bought your new cookbook, and I haven't tried anything in it yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
Take a look at the summer zucchini pasta recipe.
It's
similar to this.
I will.
Yeah, really simple and really light.
It sounds good. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you, Dee. Mm-hmm. You
Bye.
Take care.
I
Bye.
Will. Bye.
You can reach us 800-537-5252. Just remember, any sauté becomes a sauce when you add the pasta water. Just taste to make sure it's all tasting rich enough. You know, you may want to add a little more seasoning. We have got Jen calling from Silver Point, Tennessee. Jen, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. It's so great to talk with you.
Oh, thank you.
Well, my husband and I have lived in Tennessee for about 5 years.
Yeah.
And we just bought our first home last June. And
congratulations.
Thanks. During the springtime, we noticed that the tree right in front of our house started blossoming all these beautiful little flowers.
Uh-huh.
And then we saw these little berries appear. And I'm totally a city girl, have never grown anything in my life. And so I was sure that they looked like cherries to me, but I was sure that I was going to be the one that, you know, would eat this and die.
Yeah,
and
well, so, poison. Yes, I understand that totally.
Right. And so I brought a little branch of this tree into a friend of mine that I work with who has grown cherry trees before. And immediately when he saw it, he said, oh, a sour cherry tree.
And a so sour I got, cherry tree?
Yeah.
Oh.
So I got super excited. And so my husband, we waited for them all to get nice and ripe. And then my husband and I stood on, my husband, let me give him credit, stood on top of his car and picked, like, as many cherries as he possibly could.
and that's great.
Yeah. And so now we have these cherries, and it's like they came from heaven because, you know, we didn't even grow them or buy them. And
they just happened.
Yeah.
It's a bonus. So, that came with the house. It's great.
Yeah. It's just so, so special. So, of course, I thought of you and had to call you to get your ideas about how to honor these amazing sour cherries.
Well, there's a couple of things. Sour cherries are so hard to find.
Really?
And they are the prime pie cherry. They're prime cooking cherry because you can see you can sweeten them to taste, but they have a punch and they have a flavor that no sweet cherry can equal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can add the sugar, but you can't add the great character that most breeds of sour cherry bring to the party. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can. Now, one of the pain in the neck parts of this is you probably want to pit those things.
Oh, my mother-in-law is fabulous and sat there for like
3 hours
and pitted them all for us.
Now, wait a minute. Are they frozen?
They're frozen now.
Oh, you have heaven on earth.
Yeah.
All right. Here's the deal. Depending on how much you have, I would tell you to start making cherry pies like, you know, they're going out of style or little turnovers. You can do a really simple pastry dough.
Okay.
You know, really simple, and you'll find it online in cookbooks and whatever. You can even stick small quantities of it in the freezer.
Okay.
So that when you get ambitious, you take it out, it defrosts, you roll it. You can cut it in rounds, and then what you do is you mix your cherries, okay, and any juice they throw off, drain them first and put the juice aside, okay?
Okay.
We're going to use it in a minute. And what you want to do is toss it with sugar to taste, okay? For every cup of cherries, maybe a teaspoon, a little more of cornstarch.
Okay.
Okay, so that means when they cook, they won't be soupy. And then you want to add a pinch of salt. And if you'd like, you could add, if you wanted, a little cinnamon.
Ooh.
Or a couple of drops of almond extract. Don't overdo it because it could kill it. But
okay.
Yeah, because fruits like that, pitted fruits, love almond extract.
Hmm.
So you toss that together. And then what you do is you roll out your dough. You cut it into nice-sized circles. You take that juice you got from the cherry, right? Mix that with a little sugar, boil it down to a thick syrup, add that to the cherries. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're adding the cherry back to the cherry. And then you put spoonfuls of that in each round, and then you roll them over so that you seal them together like a half moon.
Wow, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, you brush that with egg, and then you sprinkle it with sugar, and you bake it at about 400 degrees. And you cut a little hole in the top or a little couple of slits so, you know, it doesn't ooze too much. And if it oozes, don't worry about it. You're doing it on a cookie sheet. You know, it's fine. But try to seal it as best you can. And then what you've got is cherry turnovers. If you put that dough in a pie plate, you've got cherry pie. Then you can do cherry jam, which you can just put in the fridge. So you boil the cherries with whatever flavorings you like and sugar. And then you can freeze that and you'll have cherry jam all winter. And then you can also do a cherry chutney, you know, where you do it with vinegar and sugar. And all kinds of spices like fresh ginger and cherries are fabulous. And you simmer that until it's really thick, and you can add chilies to that. You can add black pepper to that. You can just go on and on. Raisins, that kind of thing. And you pull that out at Thanksgiving. You can put that in sterile jars and it'll keep. But you pull that out at Thanksgiving and your turkey will be doing a tap dance on the table. I mean, you can use it all summer, obviously, with anything. And it's fabulous. And then, of course, there's, you know, you can use that as a sauce for anything, like over grilled fish or something.
Oh, yeah.
So you've got, I mean, depending on how much you've got.
We have about 7 cups pitted.
7 cups. Okay. I think that's going to give you a bunch of turnovers in a pie and a little bit of jam. But well, probably more like a generous pie or a bunch of turnovers. This is not a bad thing.
Well, no, not at all. Not at all. See, we were so clueless. You know, the birds got to it for...
Birds know what's good.
Yeah.
They do.
Thanks so much, Lynn.
Hey, you are welcome. Really enjoy that tree, and wonderful luck with the new home.
Thanks so much.
You take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252. The World Whiskey Awards took place recently in Japan, and there were a few surprises. Journalist Dave Broom covered the event for the British publication Whiskey Magazine. Dave, welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be talking to you.
Now, David, I understand that the World Whiskey Awards Prize for the best Japanese whiskey under 12 years old, I think I've got that right, raised a fuss. Now, who did it go to and why the fuss?
Well, even bigger than that, to be perfectly honest, the fuss was created because the award for the best malt whiskey in the world was given to a 20-year-old Japanese whiskey from the Yoichi distillery in Hokkaido. Now, that means that this whiskey beat all the category winners from Scotland and also from Ireland and the rest of the world. So it's been voted the best single malt whiskey in the world.
Why Scotch, or doing something resembling what the process to make Scotch, why Scotch in Japan?
Well, it kind of all started kind of tail end of the 19th century when the Japanese economy began to open up. And basically, there was a love of imported spirits, and Scotch whiskey suddenly seemed to catch the public imagination. So much so that at the beginning of the 20th century, Japanese distillers decided to try and make whiskey themselves. And a gentleman called Taketsuru-san was sent to Glasgow to study chemistry, but he ended up learning how to make whiskey in a couple of distilleries in Scotland.
Huh.
He then went back to Japan, helped set up the first Japanese malt distillery, the company that's now Suntory, and then went out on his own. And the distillery he built, this is in beginning of the 1930s, was on the island of Hokkaido, and indeed what was in fact Yoichi. The reason he built it there was because he felt that the climate of Yoichi, the quality of the water, the fact that it was peat, reminded him the most of Scotland. So he thought the conditions were perfect for making a whiskey which could rival Scotch. Not copy Scotch, but which could rival Scotch.
Huh. How have the Scots reacted to this event?
With remarkable good humour. the fact is that Japanese whiskey is subtly different from Scotch. So it's a member of the great world family of whiskey. The distillers in Japan and distillers in Scotland have had very, very long and friendly and cordial relations with each other. So it's not seen as a threat. It's seen as a, you know, an underlining that the fact that I think most people in the whiskey industry knew what was that the Japanese make fantastic whiskey and have been making fantastic whiskey for a long time. You know, this isn't. I think some people think, "Oh my goodness, you know, they've suddenly come out of nowhere." It's a 20-year-old whiskey, and the fact is, you know, it's been made for years, but it's never really been exported. And now everybody's waking up to its quality, so it's fantastic news for the whiskey category as a whole.
That's really interesting. So we may be seeing Japanese, in quotes, Scotch on the shelves here in the United States.
I sincerely hope so. I would say some specialist importers are beginning to take it. So, I mean, if you go to specialist stores in New York or Chicago or San Francisco, you will be able to pick up Japanese whiskies. They're relatively expensive, simply because cost of production is considerably higher in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But the quality of the product is extremely high, so... Well, I'd encourage everybody to give them a shot.
Well, David, thank you for talking with us.
Not at all.
David Broom is contributing editor to Britain's Whiskey magazine. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. You have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this quote from P.J. O'Rourke. He said, "Giving money and power to government is like giving whiskey and car keys to teenage boys." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Gather.com, the social network with substance where people connect around their interests. You can join the conversation about cooking at Gather.com. Information on everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Have a visit. You'll find podcasts, newsletters, a recipe archive from our very talented guests, and information on our book, How to Eat Supper. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. You have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.